this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 1st, 2009, and this is show number 189. Well, it's Super Bowl Sunday, and the Pittsburgh Steelers just pulled ahead with a wild interception raced all the way to the other end, and everyone in the show here really would rather be watching the game, but luckily we're doing halftime, so we're going to try to jump right in, see how fast we can get this done. No, I'm not going to talk faster than usual, but we'll get her done. Well, I wanted to give you guys an update on the BlackBerry Storm. As you may remember, I added my scathing review of the BlackBerry Storm to the festering pile of disgruntled reviews a few weeks back. I had the opportunity recently to be interviewed by the folks at Research in Motion as a result of that review. Verizon was on the phone as well, but they were curiously silent. The interview started out with an interesting comment by the guys from RIM. They stated that their objective of the call was to get me to change my opinion and change my review. I sort of laughed and asked them if there wasn't some little part of the conversation couldn't be dedicated to maybe them actually learning from what I had to tell them. Well, they were actually really good guys, and we had a good give and take throughout the call. They did urge me to categorize my complaints into two categories, real issues and personal preference. I thought they made a really good point. So, for example, one of my complaints was that holding down the volume button when you were listening to media actually skipped tracks when I thought it should quickly go up or down in volume. That was kind of an example of a personal preference. I'm going to try to keep that in mind for future reviews to say this is where it really does it wrong, and this is where, you know, maybe it's just my preference. Well, I did learn some very interesting things during the conversation with the guys from RIM. Remember how I mentioned that the camera came on by itself? They said this is a definite bug, and they've isolated it. They said it had to do with if you escaped out of the camera mode instead of quitting, and they do have a fix for it. Excellent news. I had also slammed them for not having Mac support for tethering. Turns out the reason I was mad was because they have an application that does work on the Mac for most models, but there's no version for the Storm on the Mac. I was bummed because USB tethering with the Storm to a PC was delightful. It was really easy to set up and very fast. Just plugged in the USB cable, you know, ran the little program, and I was online using the cell phone as an internet access point. Well, on this call, they gave me great news. While you can't tether over USB to the Mac, you can tether over Bluetooth using the exact same network preference setup you used to use to run their EVDO cards. Well, since I already have one of their EVDO cards set up from Verizon, I tried that on the Storm and it worked perfectly. So I take it all back. They are Mac-friendly, and the Bluetooth method, I don't know, it's even better in my book than USB. I mean, you don't have to carry a cable around, but I guess it does drain your battery a bit faster. Well, the biggest surprise came when they were defending the device as being great, and they told me that returns were under 10%. Well, that kind of amazed me. Now, that was a couple of weeks ago, so maybe it's gone up from now, but I still thought that was pretty amazing. But what amazed me even more was when they told me that Verizon considers anything less than 25% to be acceptable. Can you imagine thinking 25% returns is acceptable? Man, if you set the bar that low, does that mean you have to spread that 25% loss over all your other customers? Still flabbergasted when I think about it. Think about your business that you're in and think if 25% of the people gave the stuff back, or 20, that would be okay? Oh, well. Well, back on the good news front, they did recognize that it's pretty hard to hit the right letters in typing. So, you know, you remember the part where typing was the best part about a BlackBerry? Well, they said they're adjusting what they call the offsets. By offsets, they meant that they make certain assumptions about where your fingers will land, depending on if it's on the right or left side of the keyboard. If it's on the left, they assume you'll be shifted a bit to the left of the key because it's your left hand, and vice versa. They said they have a firmware update coming out that will adjust it because it's not quite right yet. I asked them that if would it be out maybe in the next couple of weeks, and they actually sort of laughed. They said, no, it has to go through Verizon's process. They didn't even make an estimate of when it would come out. Well, overall, I did tell them I wasn't changing my assessment of the device because I do believe the Storm will get better over time, but it's not there yet. They'll have to make those improvements in typing pretty significant if they're ever going to make any progress with the device. But I think they actually will, and they can. For now, I'm trading mine in for a BlackBerry Bold. Stay tuned for my review of that.
Dumb.
Dumb.
Dumb
questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I is.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Sean's going to get us started here with his dumb question. This is really a question worthy of Dumb Question Corner. I know I've sent over some out-of-the-norm stuff the last few times, so here goes. In your episode on 11809, there was a mention of cleaning your Mac, and I love to be organized, but I just can't seem to throw down the bucks to pay for a program I'm not sure about. Anyway, I caught the organized bug tonight when I fired up my Time Machine and secondary hard drive. I used just one for my Time Machine, one for a clone, and one for dumping work stuff. Okay, that's three, but to get to my point, I was looking at my documents folder and really trying to wrangle up things into larger groups so as to not have clutter. I opened my Roxio converted folder and it had nothing. I also saw my Microsoft user data folder. I opened that to see Entourage, Normal, and Office 2004 identities. I drilled down to see they're all Entourage related, which I don't even use. Since getting iWork 08 and upgrading to iWork 09, I think I use Office maybe once every 3 months and have considered dumping it all together. Anyway, back to the point. I've been meaning to ask a dumb question that's simple enough. I think this is it. I want to delete those folders and even move my QuickBooks folder somewhere else too. Does the OS just put these things here by default? And if the apps need to access those, can I find them once I move them? Well, I think this one's a little bit tricky, Sean. Not sure it qualifies as dumb question, but here's my opinion anyway. I'm sure people will tell me if I'm wrong. As far as the Entourage identities, I'm sure you can throw that stuff away if you don't use Entourage. That should have no effect on your occasional Microsoft Office use either. You might have to enter some personal information again, possibly, but probably not. I'm with you on dropping Office. Well, except for Excel. I might keep that forever. Numbers just doesn't work the way I think, so I'm an Excel fanatic, you know that. Now, on to the other folders. Some applications nowadays really want their files in a particular place, I think. Like Feeder, for example, puts my feeds in a folder inside the library of all things. I wouldn't dare move that one. QuickBooks might be the same way. One thing I think you could do with QuickBooks is a quick experiment. Make a change in QuickBooks and save and quit. Then look at the modified date on the folder in question to verify you're looking at the right one. Make sure it's just been updated. Now move the folder to the preferred location and launch QuickBooks again. Make another modification. I guess I'm assuming that it launched without borking on you because it couldn't find the files. I'm assuming it does launch. If it does launch, make another change, save it out, and check the modified date again to make sure it found the right folder. If it does all that, then you're probably okay. Worst case scenario is that doesn't work, and all you have to do is move it back, and you learn something. Let me know if that works. Well, remember last week when I said there weren't any dumb questions? I forgot all about Pat's question, which she was nice enough to remind me. I'm going to summarize it because we had a bunch of solutions and we didn't find an answer, so we're putting it to you guys to find a solution. Here's the basic premise. In Safari, when Pat types in a few letters for the URL, several URLs show up. She wants to get rid of them, acknowledging that this is normally a feature. She dumped her history, she dumped her bookmarks, everything she doesn't want. She cleaned her cache, and the URLs she didn't want were gone, along with her bank site, which is the one she's trying to get to. But when she went to the bank site and saved it as a bookmark on the login screen, she then went back to access it, and another bank site popped up in the first place again, like in the list. It was the first thing that came up. She then tried to bookmark the bank site after the login screen, and again, she had other sites showing up as offerings before her link. As she said, it seems that Safari thinks it knows where I want to go and what I want to do better than I do. I tried to bow out of this problem because it was too hard, but she's desperate and asked that I query you guys for help. Any ideas for Pat? Well, right when I finished doing that recording, I looked over at the chat room on Ustream. That would be ustream.tv/nosilicast. I looked down and Connor said he knows the answer to the problem. He says switch to Firefox and use the awesome bar. Well, thanks. I don't think that's quite what she's looking for, but not a bad idea. David sent in a review of iPhoto 09 that I think you're going to find surprising.
Hi, Allison. Dave calling from Eugene, Oregon with my iPhoto review. I was really looking forward to getting the new version of iPhoto. I installed it the first or second day it came out and began playing right away. And was really quite disappointed. I've been using keywords to tag names to photos for quite some time, and it was a cumbersome process to start. But once I did it, I found that it was just great because then I could, of course, search for photos of specific people and get some very accurate results because I'd gone to the trouble of keywording them all. Now, it's a little bit cumbersome to have to go through and do that every time you take a roll of photos, but it doesn't take that long once you get used to it, and it is totally accurate. Well, faces, I thought, would be a great way of replacing this piece of my workflow. But upon using it, I find that that is not the case. When I started with faces, I used myself and then found out that it's just not that accurate. It recognized about 125 pictures of me out of the 900 or so in my library. And out of those, maybe 20% weren't me. They were anything from a 9-year-old girl it thought was me to my grandfather. So not only was it incomplete, it was inaccurate. And to me, I don't really see the function of something. You know, if it's intended that I can find pictures of people and, you know, I got this picture in mind and I want to find it, I'm going to go to faces and click on their face and search for the picture. It doesn't really work like that because if you don't go to all the trouble of confirming each picture every time you upload them, it may or may not know who that is. So to me, it really serves very little purpose, in practical use. I was also disappointed with places. I had some pictures from my iPhone that I had taken, and they were all at the same location, but places pulled up, and they were within a mile radius of each other, which to me is pretty inaccurate considering the keynote. They kind of mentioned that, you know, you could track your trip around the Eiffel Tower and, you know, spot to spot to spot and see where you took pictures. But, you know, I was in a 3G area. You know, the GPS was obviously on, but it just was not that accurate in order to do that kind of thing. More disappointing to me was that I went and I tried to drag the pins to make it accurate, and that's not available as a function. So even when you find things that are not accurate, you just have to live with them being inaccurate, which was really frustrating to me and seemed like something that you should be able to fix in places. So I find both new features to be quite disappointing, and yeah, that's just my take on it. So I do love iPhoto. I love the event. It's my browser of choice. But this new version really didn't live up to what I thought it had the potential of being. So thank you for listening to this, and thank you for all your work on the show. It's a great service to the Mac community. Have a great day.
Wow, David, that sure isn't what we expected to hear about iPhoto after all the hype. You know, I don't use iPhoto myself very much, but I know people were really hoping that Faces feature would work perfectly. The good news is that these algorithms are probably only going to get better over time. I actually saw this feature demoed during Demo Fall 08. The company was called I Love Photos, and I'm 99% positive that's the company that Apple bought, or they bought their technology. I heard later on that they had bought the technology, and the way it looks, I mean, with the corkboard and everything, it looked exactly like that during the demo. One thing they said on the show floor was that figuring out who someone was in profile was very difficult. You mentioned that if somebody's face was to the side, it didn't recognize them. They seemed to need both eyes at this time. On the geotagging front, I can't believe that you can't move the pins around in places when they're inaccurately laid down. Wonder if you could change the latitude and longitude manually? But then again, that's like using the command line when you just finished paying for a beautiful GUI. At least allowing you to move the pins around would compensate for their inaccuracy. Sounds like a real missed opportunity. By the way, Van in the chat room is saying that you can move the pins around, so I asked him to send an email to me describing how to do it, and maybe there's a trick in there that we just missed. Maybe it's holding down the Option key or one of those kind of things. Well, it is going to be interesting to see what updates Apple comes with over time to improve the facial recognition. I sure hope they improve the geotagging for you. Thanks for sending in such a well-thought-out review, David. I thank you for your kind words as well. Well, as you've no doubt figured out, I really enjoy Twitter. I enjoy hearing what's happening in the inner tubes through Twitter, following my geekier friends, and getting answers to my tech questions. When the Mac Crack guys, Justin and David, came here to visit from Ireland, Justin told me how he really likes TweetDeck from TweetDeck.com. I tried TweetDeck a while back, but it just took up way too much room on the desktop because you've got all these columns of people and tweets. It's like four columns wide. It takes up almost the entire desktop. Justin explained to me during our little meetup that you can modify the options to be more desktop friendly. But as soon as he left, of course, I forgot to go test it. Then he tweeted me about it. Then he tweeted me again. Finally, he figured out how to get me to try it. He sent me a screen steps tutorial. Yep, how better than to show someone who's hesitant how easy something is than to send them a beautifully formatted step-by-step instruction sheet complete with lovely annotated screen snapshots. He was able to point at the relevant icons on the screen so I could tell just what I had to do in order to tailor TweetDeck so it was much more manageable. Not only was the tutorial wonderful for me, it was trivial for Justin to create because ScreenSteps makes it so easy. All he had to do was click the little camera icon, drag it across the area on the tool, and click to make annotations, type in some text to guide me even further, and then click Export to PDF. ScreenSteps even opens the folder you save to when you're done, so you can open it or drag it into an email just like Justin did for me. If you'd like to be able to make the most complex and elaborate manuals, complete with automatically generated tables of contents, or the simplest short tutorials for boneheads like me, check out ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com. And be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, to get 25% off your purchase price. Think about it. If you apply the discount code to the pro price of $60, that makes it only $5 more than the standard price that normal people pay. Imagine $45 for all that happiness. By the way, I put a link in the show notes to the Mac Crack website where Justin has posted his tutorial. Well, I need to throw in a quick iPhone iPod Touch application here. My buddy Ron turned me onto an application that has filled me with joy. It may not be as wild and sexy as the Ocarina, and it probably won't help you make millions of dollars or anything like that, but it will solve a real problem. It's called DVR Remote from StutzmanSoft.com. Now, having a good remote for your TiVo may not be your biggest problem, but bear with me until you hear the best part about this application. So, DVR Remote works with the Series 3 HD or HD XL TiVo models. They have to be on your wireless network. I mean, they can be wired, but you have to have a wireless network. And that way you're going to get to them through your iPhone iPod Touch on your wireless network. So, you launch the application and you enable network remote control on your TiVo. They tell you exactly how to do that on the TiVo when you're setting it up. Then you'll see all your TiVos listed on the iPhone screen. If you have more than one, that is. You'll see one if you only have one. Anyway, DVR Remote looks very similar to the remote control for the TiVo, but not exactly so similar as to get sued. All of the buttons are in the same location with the same functionality. Right from your iPhone or iPod Touch, you can check out your Now Playing list, read the information about the episodes you already have recorded, and look at your favorites list. At this point, the DVR remote is just kind of handy. Say you can't find your real TiVo remote, or you're too lazy to reach over and get it, and you already got your iPhone in your hand. But here comes the really, really cool part. You know how incredibly annoying it is to enter text on a TiVo? Like when you're searching for a show you want to record? You've got that big old grid of letters, and you have to go over 2, down 3, hit enter, back up 2, go to the right, 3, hit enter, on and on and on, and it takes forever, right? Well, there's one button on DVR remote that isn't on the real TiVo remote. That's a keyboard button. Yes, hit this once, and you've got the iPhone touchscreen keyboard right there to enter the text. Now, that would be pretty cool, because it does make it easier, but they added a level of delight to this that you have to hear and see to appreciate. DVR remote does not send the signal to the TiVo as you enter each character. It waits until you've completely finished, and then it sends them all in rapid fire to the TiVo. The best part is the TiVo still displays on screen all that up, over, left, down nonsense, complete with all the silly TiVo sounds. It's hysterical. Steve and I love this so much, we just keep searching for TiVo shows we have no intention of actually recording, just trying to hear it do this. We try to find the longest ones possible so we can get even more entertainment. We made a quick little video to put in the show notes so you can see how this works, but for now, here's an audio clip of how fast this thing goes. Right before the sound clip, I had gone through all the menus to look to find new programs, so we'll pick it up from there. Now, the funnest thing to look for so far I found is NBA basketball, because that's got lots and lots of letters. So we're going to go in, we're going to click this button, which is the keyboard. So I'm going to type in NBA, and you'll notice that the TiVo isn't doing anything at all right now. So it's saving up all these characters, basketball. And watch what happens. Here we go. You get ready, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Isn't that hilarious? I love it. That's my favorite part. I love DVR remote. Oh, my gosh. I just can't stop laughing at that. I played it twice for the chat room. Oh, God, that just makes me giggle every time it does it. Anyway, DVR remote is a whopping $3, but I contest that it is worth it for the entertainment value alone, if not the incredible increase in your productivity. Go check it out at StutzmanSoft.com.
George from Tulsa here. If you're like me, you've imported a lot of pictures with cryptic file names assigned by your camera. Wouldn't it be nice to easily rename groups of files and give them names that make sense? Like to put Macworld 2009 on all your Macworld Expo pictures? It is easy with namemangler.app. Donationware downloadable at minitricks.com. Not name manager, not name away in the manger. Name mangler. Bulk renames any data files on your Mac, not just pictures. Check podfeet.com for a link to name mangler and screen grabs I sent Allison showing the program in use. Hard to describe, easy to show.
Well, George made us a detailed tutorial that you're really going to want to go check out. He didn't use screen steps, though. I don't understand that. So I converted it pretty painlessly myself so that the screen grabs would be of manageable size, and then I could just output it as a beautiful PDF for downloading for you. I put a link to it in the show notes so you can go check that out. Well, how many operating systems do you think Allison actually needs? I've been on a positive frenzy in the last 2 weeks, loading up operating systems. I don't know what's gotten into me. It's like an illness. Well, you remember last week I told you I put Windows 7 on the HP Mini Note, right? And then I loaded the open source VirtualBox from Sun Microsystems on my Mac, and I threw Windows 7 on that. Nothing went wrong, well, except for my continuing network issues, which my buddy Ron verified happened to him too when he did it on his MacBook. Well, nothing's really gone wrong, so I threw Ubuntu on VirtualBox too on my Mac. Well, I still didn't have any problems, so then it was time to go back to my adventures trying to put Ubuntu on the OLPC, or one laptop per child. Remember that story? When last we left our hero, she had started with the intrepid Ubuntu instructions for the OLPC at olpcnews.com/forum. I put a link in the show notes directly to that. Daunted nearly immediately and not understanding even the basic idea of the process, that didn't stop me. Of course, I turned to Bart in Ireland to weed through the lingo and get me rolling. I got along fairly badly, needing quite a bit of hand-holding. I got hung up on little things like the fact that there's no sudo on my OLPC, only switch user su. Anyway, Bart helped me through to the end where it was supposed to boot from the SD card. And it said, SDHCI card didn't power up after 1 second. What? What am I supposed to do now? Well, Bart was baffled, and he suggested that I post to those forums where I'd found the instructions. I argued with him for a while, telling him to figure it out, but he finally convinced me to go ahead and post there. I found a slew of people talking about the problem, and they seemed to think it had something to do with partitioning, like people had 8-gig cards and they partitioned them into 2 4s, that kind of thing. But nobody there really seemed to have a good answer. Well, I festered on that for a while, and then one day, one of my newer interweb buddies, Nightwise, from Nightwise.com, that's Night spelled with a K-N-I-G-H-T, and Nightwise is from Belgium, and he came on chat and asked me how things were going. I think he'd seen my tweets of angst about the OLPC Ubuntu adventure. See, Nightwise is a hardcore Linux guy who does a podcast, and he actually talks about how to install software in Linux while he's driving his car. I mean, really good, detailed instructions. It's great. You should go check it out. Anyway, since I knew he was a hardcore Linux guy, I jumped at the chance to pick his brains on this. Unfortunately, he was baffled as well. He suggested I post on the regular Ubuntu forums. I told him I was scared that the real Linux people use this foreign language altogether. I seriously think I understand more Klingon than I do what they talk about in the forums. Well, he dug around and found a guy who had posted a successful Ubuntu install on his OLPC. He suggested I post on that page. I told him I was still scared. So then he suggested I use two terms to convince them to be gentle with me, noob and girl. I have to admit that I did just as he suggested. Well, I was desperate, I tell you. Yeah, I called myself a girl and a noob. All right. Noob I was pretty comfortable with, but using girl just so they'd go easy on me? I cheapened myself. But I did get an answer. Jerome G. from the Philippines was the guy who'd been successful before, and he knew the solution. Would you believe that for some reason SanDisk cards won't power up in less than 1 second? He had tried a couple of them, and then he went for an off-brand, and it worked. I ran out to the store, bought a PNY 2-gig card, I ran through the same installer scripts, and in about an hour, I was up and running Ubuntu on my OLPC. Now, Allison getting Ubuntu running isn't really the interesting part of the story to me. See, I'm in the United States and California. I work very often with Bart in Ireland. Then from there, I worked with Nightwise in Belgium, who helped me find Jerome in the Philippines. And guess what Jerome wrote back to me when I thanked him for helping me? He wrote, "I didn't notice until I saw your signature. I'm actually subscribed to your podcast since last year. I'm also a Mac user at work, so it's been very helpful. Thanks for what you've been doing." Isn't that crazy? The United States to Ireland to Belgium to the Philippines, and I find a no-silicast listener. You know what? I love the internet. By the way, you can follow my new friend Jerome G on Twitter at twitter.com/JeromeGotenko. And luckily I put that in the show notes. And check out his blog Engage the World at engage.wordpress.com.
G'day, Al. It's Rose from Slobot. First up, I want to say, your mum is dead set, one top Sheila. Then I want to say to all the Sillycast listeners that if you have a Honda or an Acura and you live in LA or Orange County and you don't get Honda Bob to look after it, then you're a bloody drongo. Dead set, you're a mug, because he's a bonza bloke. Your choice. Take it out west to the dodgy brother's auto and have some bogan bludger leave his greasy paw prints all over it, or get Al's cobber Honda Bob out to your place. Ridgy did, she's a fair dinkum bloke. His blood's worth bottling. While you're spine bashing with the cricket and sinking a few tinnies with your mates, he's in your shed having a Captain Cook at your cactus car. Next thing you know, it's as right as rain. So chuck him a tinny. You'd be a mongrel if you didn't. And whenever your Honda or Acura needs some lovin', give Honda Bob a cooey on 562-531-2321 or go to hdabob.com. But hey, remember, he's not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. That's the advert done. And Bartalicious, I reckon it's your turn next. Now, I recorded this on the iPhone with a couple of apps from Griffin Technologies. iTalk Recorder, which installs on the iPhone, and iTalk Sync, which installs on your desktop machine. Both are free. You can upgrade to iTalk Recorder Premium for $5.99, which is ad-free. I won't, because the ads don't bother me. I think the audio quality is great, but the only way to sync back to my MacBook is through Wi-Fi, which is a little annoying. I have no Wi-Fi at work, so I'll have to wait till I get home to send this off. But all up, I think this is a bonza app. And hey, I promise not to talk so much strine next time. Copies later.
Well, Rose, that was different. I love that Honda Bob is an international superstar now. Well, luckily, Rose was nice enough to include a translator for us, or as Steve just said in the chat room, a Rosetta Stone. Get it? Get the pun? Anyway, these terms she used, she calls them strine. I'm not sure what strine means, but I guess it means these terms. Anyway, I put the Rosetta Stone in the show notes so you, too, can learn a foreign language. The only thing that Rose did forget was Honda Bob's email address, which is hdabob@aol.com. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartb.ie. Happy Sunday, Bart.
Yay! It's weird. Now I think I have a whole extra day of weekend that I don't because we're recording on the wrong day.
I got really confused when I woke up and realized we hadn't recorded yet. That was very disturbing. We don't like change.
Moment of panic. No! Oh, wait, no, it's later.
Well, let's see. I wanted to start off with one quick little rant. Yesterday I had to reboot my machine because I'd loaded iLife 09, and I'm not going to talk about iLife 09 because I haven't actually played with it yet. But my machine was booting up, and it was getting all ready to go, and I really needed to search, you know, launch some applications. But I knew I knew that Quicksilver hadn't launched yet because I hadn't seen the little logo come up. But I thought, let me see if Spotlight works. So I hit the command space bar, and sure enough, Spotlight was there. I got in one letter, and it locked up, and it crashed. Not my whole system, but Spotlight crashed.
So how did it uncrash, or what happened next? Or?
I had to go into Activity Monitor and kill the process. I waited like 10 minutes, and it was still churning away and cranking my processors. I suppose I shouldn't say it crashed. It hung, and I had to force quit it.
Ooh, that's not good.
No.
And then what happened? Did it start itself up again, or
yeah,
did it just have no
Yeah, it did start itself
glass.
Up again. Yeah, it did start itself up again. But in the meantime, of course, I wouldn't use Quicksilver to launch my application while I was waiting for Spotlight. So Spotlight sucks.
Well, Quicksilver wasn't going to work either, since it wasn't there.
But at least it wasn't pretending to work, see?
I never do anything on either. It's something I learned from Windows. You never do anything until your desktop is fully rendered and ready to go.
Well, actually, I think Apple is starting to emulate Windows in that, is that it used to be that you couldn't start doing anything on the Mac until it was ready, and Windows would pretend it was ready by drawing the desktop. In fact, when my desktop is rendered on Windows, it's nowhere near ready. It's quite a long time till all the applications are actually there. But it looks
it's
like
the
Apple
same way in my G4.
Well,
my G4 Mac Mini is like that as well, because, well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 menu bar apps is probably too many for it.
Yeah, maybe that is it. But there should be some indicator. I'm ready now.
Yeah, well, when the hard disk stops thrashing.
I guess so. Well, you had some exciting news, right?
Yes, I sold a photograph.
Woo!
Yes, my first ever one. I have gotten money for a photograph before, but that was when I gave away and then got some money for as a thank you, which isn't quite the same thing. So this is a case where someone contacted me on Flickr and said, hello, I run a local company and we'd like to use your photo on our website. Here's the link. And I wrote back sort of thinking, well, they're probably not going to agree to this. But I said, well, look, if you're a charity, I'd give it to you for free. But since you make money, you know, I need to cover my costs too. So I'm happy to sell you a license. How does €100 sound? And they wrote back and went, yeah, that's great. I was like, oh.
Wow. You go, dang, should ask for 200.
Yeah. Well, no, I decided I was just going to ask for what I wanted. And then if they said no, I was going to go, yeah, whatever.
That's cool. Do you want to give out the company name or wait until they put it up or...
Wait till they put it up, I guess. Oh. It's a local solicitor's firm, so I'm curious what they're going to do with it, because it's a picture of a castle.
Ah, cool. Well, that's really neat. All that work's paid off.
Yeah, it got a bit of excitement on Twitter, and I think some people were asking, so, you know, did you have to sign over your copyright and stuff? And I didn't want to do that. So I just said, look, perpetual license, that's what you're getting. I still retain copyright, and that was not a problem.
Cool. So did you do any formal documentation or just those words?
I wrote up an invoice that said perpetual license for use in any medium of the following image, copied and pasted in the image, and stuck €100 next to it and sent off the invoice.
That sounds good. I think a lot of times that's just fine.
Yeah, and they're a firm of solicitors, so I'm sure they know what I mean. And if they interpret something different, I'm going to lose anyway. So there's no point in spending time.
Exactly. Well, let's see. You finally got your external hard drive, so you were able to load up Aperture 2, right?
Yeah, it seems like ages ago, but it was only Monday. It's funny how these things change. But yeah, so on Monday morning, my little passport drive arrived. And remember I had said that it was all, you know, it looked cool and blue and funky.
Oh,
it looks crappy in blue, actually, rather than cool and blue. So next time I'm getting a black one.
Oh, yeah. So that was which drive was it? And why did you hate that?
It's the passport drive, the little Western Digital passport. So it's like a MyBook, only way smaller.
Okay, but it was ugly, huh?
Yeah, I thought the blue was going to be a cool metallic blue and it was going to look all shiny and cool. It's really dirt cheap plastic blue, the kind of stuff I used to use in metalwork at school.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's not pretty. For those of you in Ireland, it looks like Perspex, which I think you guys call plexiglass. But yeah, I should have gone for a black one and be normal. And that's the last time I tried to be cool with a company that's not Apple, I guess. But bottom line, it does actually contain data and it does actually work as a hard drive, which is sort of the main thing.
Well, that's good.
And it meant I finally had room to get, you know, my iPhoto off my hard disk and then Aperture onto my hard disk.
So now your idea in doing the passport was you want to have your data with you at all times, but the drive inside your laptop isn't big enough, so this way you can have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and that's why I went for a small drive, which is why I went for the passport. So it doesn't have external power. It's powered straight off the USB, so it comes with just one cable, no messing. None of those funny two-headed cables either, just one simple cable.
I have one of those two-headed cables. I hate it because it's not quite long enough to fit all the way around my MacBook Pro. It just makes it really tedious.
Yeah, so this is nice, and it does work. So I got Aperture installed, and I've been using it. So I didn't change my ways in some ways because I'm using Aperture in the iPhoto way. I have it's a managed library. It has imported everything. It is referencing nothing. So no, I actually did disagree on that one.
No. I actually did do that because you'd preached to me so many times, just give in, just let it control things. So
yeah.
It is controlling things. I'm still a little disturbed by it, but it does allow me a lot more control of folders and things than I had on iPhoto. So I'm happier with that, nested folders and that sort of thing.
The other thing, which you, I'm not sure you're doing it, but if you reference your images instead of letting it suck them in, you can't use aperture volts for backup. Aperture volts.
Talk about that. I have no idea what that is. I haven't even clicked that button yet.
Okay, so I have two volts set up already because I am paranoid about my data. I always have been and probably always will be.
But what is a vault?
So the idea is that a vault is a managed backup that Aperture manages. So Aperture knows how many volts you have, it knows what they're called, and it recognizes them when you plug them in. So a vault is just a file on an external hard disk that looks like an Aperture library, but it has a slightly different icon. Whenever you edit an image, Aperture keeps a list of what's changed since the last time your vault was synced. Mm-hmm. And so when you plug in a hard drive with one of your vaults and that Aperture goes, oh, look, there's that vault. And then you can click a little button that says sync them up. And then it will back up whatever needs to be backed up to that vault. So you can have one
exactly like Super Duper already does for my entire hard drive. Why would I want a separate vault thingy in Aperture?
Because it manages all the metadata and stuff, and it's very efficient. So you can have one at work and one at home. And so you bring your laptop in and you plug it in at work and you go, take my Aperture library and make it safe.
But that's just a backup. I mean, I've got Super Duper already doing incremental backups. So every time I back up, it is moving all that metadata, just like Aperture, except Aperture's only doing the Aperture library.
Okay, but I don't actually do disk cloning. So well, this
how,
is actually, it's really nicely managed. It's actually very efficient. If you're going to, I mean, do you keep an offsite clone of your entire disk?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then you're fine.
But it's actually backwards. The offsite is on-site. my backup hard drive. Well, my no. Stay with me here. My backup drive lives at home, and my laptop lives in the car with me wherever I go. So whenever I'm not, my laptop's never more than about a foot away from me at any time. So even if the house caught fire, it'd still be within reaching distance. So when I'm not at home, my laptop's with me. So I keep my backup drive at home.
I'm not sure I'd count that as offsite.
They're not in the same place. If they're not in the same place, it's offsite backup. Absolutely.
I'd like to think that if an earthquake or something struck, that you would actually go to safety and not go looking for your laptop.
You're assuming that my laptop is not within arm's reach, and it is. I mean, even when I'm cooking, it's in the kitchen. It's not in the living room, you know? It stays right with me at all times.
Okay, the fire warden in me, because I did go through fire warden training, is saying, no!
Okay,
you're supposed to run and leave everything behind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't think I'm going to reach for my laptop?
Okay, you probably are, but yeah. You probably shouldn't.
That's me. Probably shouldn't. I'll give you shouldn't. But anyway, so, are you saying you don't have incremental backups going of your system?
I have Time Machine running on my system. And
okay.
I have an offsite backup I sync up from time to time of my important files, but it's not an entire system.
We're not talking about an entire backup, an entire clone of the entire system. We're just talking about a backup that would also contain your Aperture library backup. So if you've got Time Machine running, you've already got all that incremental information.
No, I don't, because my Aperture library is not on my hard disk.
So you're,
it does
okay.
not show up in my Time Machines. And I wouldn't edit anyway because it'd be, if it's versioning that every hour, I'm going to balloon my Time Machine.
Okay, and that's, now we're back to why I hate Time Machine. So I run a Super Duper backup, whether it's a full clone or not, isn't really relevant to this discussion. I run a backup once a week of that, and that is an incremental backup, which is why I don't use Time Machine, because it balloons like ridiculousness. So I am already doing what Aperture's doing in file, and it's vaulting then, except I'm getting more than Aperture, right?
Yeah, but if you use Aperture's vaults, it will actually tell you how many images are not backed up at any time, which is a really nice little reminder to be getting.
Hmm. I still won't do it more than once a week, so...
I do it whenever I've done any amount of work, actually. And the one at work doesn't get done as often because the laptop isn't there as often. Mm-hmm. But the one at home is very religiously synced to its vault.
I see. Okay. Well, anyway, let's talk about what you hate about Aperture.
No, hate is the wrong word.
You seem to have a really long list about it.
Okay, it's... I was surprised because iPhoto is literally, Apple literally give it away. It's, you know, it's not a particularly high-end product. They give it free with every Mac. And I certainly didn't expect to lose functionality by going from an app they give away for free to an app they charge $200 for it on its own.
Okay, we probably shouldn't call it for free because it is part of the Apple tax and you have to buy it if you don't have the latest version. So it's not really for free, but it's like one 25th of $79. It's $20.
Yeah, exactly. So,
so
you know, whatever way you want to slice the bacon, it's either $20 or free, but it's certainly at least 10 times less than the Pro tool
that
is Aperture.
Okay.
So I was not expecting any downsides at all. I was expecting all gain and no loss, which is not the reality. Which I was surprised by that. So I did spend quite a bit of time on my post going through that because I was writing my blog post from the point of view of an iPhoto user moving to Aperture and what the gotchas are. And I think that's important information to get out there. And so that's sort of what I concentrated on.
Okay.
Yeah. So, okay, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, one of the things you said at the beginning of your blog post is it's really designed for people who shoot RAW. I disagree with that. It accommodates people who shoot for RAW, but it works great for me not shooting RAW at all.
I'd invert that statement. It accommodates you great, but really, I when I'm editing a RAW photo versus editing a JPEG, the thing really comes into its own on the RAWs. I mean, it's great for the JPEGs. It's still an improvement over iPhoto on the editing of the JPEGs. I mean, I cannot fault the actual photo editing. The controls work beautifully. They're
okay, but what
I find them intuitive, and they're very powerful. But
what I'm
if you're shooting
is,
RAW,
what I'm
you're
worried
really
about is people looking at it and saying, "Oh, I don't shoot RAW. This application's not for me." And that's absolutely not true. It's definitely for people who shoot JPEGs, no doubt. I mean, there's tons and tons and tons of controls that you don't get in any other application combined, all those tools for JPEG. It might be awesome for RAW, but it's also really awesome for JPEG.
See, if you're getting to the point where you want these controls and where this level of power is, you know, what you crave, I would argue it may be time to start shooting RAW.
And I would argue against that. But maybe we'll save that for a RAW versus JPEG smackdown. This is supposed to be a review of our Aperture. But
the downside of RAW is that you have all this tweaking ability afterwards. And you're going to do all that tweaking anyway, so why not do it on a RAW? The only downside is hard disk tax.
I think we both come at this from what we want to do with it. You come at it as a photographer who spends a lot of time tweaking every photo and getting the precision that you want. I take it as I take mostly photographs of people where if I've captured the person, they're in focus, the lighting looks good, and it's cropped well, I never touch the photo at all. 90% of my photos get no editing whatsoever. So, but when I need it, I've got the tools there that I need. So, and I'm enjoying it as much as you are. So I think it's good to realize that it hits both ends of the spectrum, at least.
Okay, so, but are you not, okay, some of the things that have hit me in terms of organization are, I always wrote descriptions of my events. And they have simply vanished into the ether when I did the upgrade, because iPhoto doesn't allow me to have some text associated with a project.
You mean Aperture doesn't?
Aperture. It doesn't allow me to have a description of a project, which I think is insane.
See, I always did it in folders, so Aperture exactly matches the way I did it, which is I can create a project within a folder where the folder gives me a date range, and then the project name is the name of the event.
That's great. I'm now mimicking your folder structure to a large extent. I have folders for years, and then they contain events. But
I didn't put my descriptions in. That would have never occurred to me.
Especially when I was scanning in old photographs, I would put in metadata, which was a guess, and I would write in the description, you know, I'm totally guessing about this date, but I know it was before this and it was after that, so it was sometime within this 15-day period, so I took the middle point as my guess. And all that information is gone. I've lost it.
Interesting.
And it's supposed to be better at organizing your photos. You know, you're not supposed to lose stuff. You also lose power with smart folders. And surely you should be getting smarter smart folders for a pro tool instead of dumber smart folders.
Now, talk to what bothered you about that.
I had a very simple smart folder. I thought it was a very simple smart folder. I use it all the time. I have my photo of the week event running on the blog, and believe it or not, it actually takes a bit of effort to go through my 3,000 photographs and pick out one of them to have as a photo of the week. And obviously, I don't scan through all of my library every week. So every folder I have marked as a favorite gets sucked into a folder, into a smart album, and then every one of those that is not already in the album photo of the week gets... Sorry, everyone that is in the album photo of the week then gets subtracted out. So you're left with all of your favorites that have not yet been photo of the week. Which is the perfect subset to choose a photo of the week from.
Okay.
So to do that, you need a smart album that is aware of albums, where you can say two core criteria, you know, has to be rated a favorite and has to not be a member of this album. There is no way in Aperture to have the is not a member of this album.
Okay.
That functionality is not there.
You can set things like, let's say I wanted a folder. What I want to make clear is that there is the not function. It does exist. It's like if I want a folder that has pictures of Steve that don't include pictures of Lindsay, I can do that. Because I can say I want file name is not empty and does contain Steve and does not contain Lindsay, that sort of thing.
Actually, it's not even that powerful because... You have to have, it's the entire thing. If you have three criteria, it's either and them all or them all.
No, that's not true. I'm doing it right now. I just created, you can go into other metadata and add file name includes Steve and does not include Lindsay.
Okay, that's within a subquery. But if you have three things, you can't have one thing or the other thing and the other thing. It's either this or this or this or this and this and this. At your very top level, you have
I lost you, sorry.
Okay, when you start off making your smart folder, right next to the first text field, you have a drop-down that says all or any.
Right. But then
there's nothing more powerful than that. It's either all or any.
Okay, but I can say all, and I can say does contain Steve, does not contain Lindsay.
Yes, exactly. But you can't build up more complex queries where you have... this and this or this. It's either this and this and this or this or this or this.
Okay, you might be in the outside realm of people who build really complex queries. It's possible.
I may be. I'm also a computer scientist who's fascinated by being how one can construct these things.
Right.
But it's limited. And the fact that it's... I mean, the one in iPhoto has its limits too. Don't get me wrong. But why should the one in Aperture have more limits than the one in iPhoto?
Hmm.
And also, the iPhoto's interface is so much nicer for smart folders. It's so easy. Whereas the Aperture one, it took me quite a while to wrap my head around it, actually. It was doing very odd things. Oh, yes, that's the thing that really drove me insane. Perhaps a little like you. I'm a little, anal about keeping stuff organized. So I always had my smart folders in a folder so that I could collapse them and have them hidden. Problem is, if you put a smart folder in a folder, it only searches photos in that folder. So my smart folders were finding absolutely nothing. And the only way I can get my smart folders to find everything is to put them at the top level.
Yeah, now this is...
where they're always in the way.
No. You're wrong. and you'll be really glad to know you're wrong about this.
How do I make them not do that?
I'll tell you. So this is the thing that took me the longest time to get off the ground with Aperture, because I didn't understand the way folders versus albums versus projects. I got really tangled at the beginning, and I simply didn't start until I figured it out. Create a project called Smart Albums, and then put all of your Smart Albums inside there. And now they're all off the top level, and they do function. I tested it before we got on the air. So it's not...
counterintuitive, but I'll give it a go. If it fixes my problem, I'm game.
Yeah, you gotta really keep paying attention to what a project does versus a folder versus an album versus a smart album. It's not completely intuitive, and it's taken me a while, and now I just try all of them until I find the one that does what I want. So I did create a smart albums folder, and I think because the project's at the top level. If you put that project inside a folder, you're right, that would happen. You'd be back where you got wrecked. But that way, at least, you don't have to have 50 smart albums laying around at your top level, which would be really cluttery.
Leads me to another problem, is I had nested smart albums.
Okay, and then that gets back
to
your logic thing.
I'm just not going to be able to do.
Yeah,
I'm just not going to be able to do that, because I had one for, this is quite nerdy now, but I had one for old Belgian trains, and then within that I had smart albums for all different types. And so I could collapse them away. which made organization nice. I can get all Belgian trains. I can get all Belgian.
No, that's
type,
interesting.
Whatever trains.
The reason I didn't like one of the main things I didn't like about iPhoto was you couldn't have nested albums. You could have nested smart albums, but not nested regular albums.
Yeah, well, you can use folders to nest albums. It got a bit confusing in its terminology as well. Let's have no complication about that.
Okay.
But I've lost power with my smart albums, and I don't think they should have gotten dumber.
Okay, you know, I really hate to be this depressing. Do you like anything about Aperture?
Yeah, actually, just let me go through. Oh, yeah, I've actually found some solutions to things I didn't like as well, because I did this blog post yesterday, and people have been replying to it, which is really great. One of the things I love about the internet. So I complained bitterly because I lost my rule of thirds guide in the Aperture cropping tool. This is a sort of a tic-tac-toe grid that photographers use for making up compositions. Ideally speaking, you want vertical features on one of the lines in your tic-tac-toe grid. You want your horizon on either the top third or the bottom third. And, you know, subjects are best at the crossing points of the tic-tac-toe grid.
Okay.
So when you're cropping, it's really handy to see that grid. And in iPhoto, that's exactly what happens. When you use a cropping tool, you get that grid. And so I opened up Aperture, went to crop my first photo, and went, ah! Because the grid wasn't there. Apparently, if you hold down the command key, it comes up, which it does.
Oh,
which I have to thank a commenter who I think was called Tim. I really hope I got that right.
Oh, I see.
Apologies if I didn't. But there was no menu item to do that, so it was just one of the things you just kind of have to know. And actually, that's quite a lot of that in Aperture. It's very keyboard-oriented, especially in full-screen mode.
Interesting.
So that was one thing where I was going, oh my God, oh my God, and then that got itself sorted out.
I would tell you why I thought that isn't in there is I think this is for the high-end photographer who maybe already has a clue to what one-third looks like. I would crop it to my eye of what looked right, not thinking I had to be mathematically on one-third.
Yeah, well, you don't put it exactly on the thirds, but the guides are very handy, and a lot of pro-end cameras have the guides actually on the viewfinder.
Huh.
Which you only get in pro-end cameras, so that sort of counters that a little. It's an odd one, but anyway, I have a solution. Hold down the command key.
Okay, so do you like anything about Aperture, Bart?
Oh, there's lots of things I love, and I mean really
please
love.
Please talk about something you like.
Well, no, okay, like, it's much easier to talk about things you don't like, because then you have to explain them. Whereas things that are great is a one-liner. They are great. It's very hard to say more. So although my blog post is very weighted, you know, in terms of lines, there's a lot of lines dedicated to the bad and not so many lines to the good, but the good completely outweighs the bad. I would never go back to iPhoto. You could pay me and I wouldn't. I just wouldn't.
That's shocking from what you've talked about so far. It sounds like you hate it.
No, it's all right. At the end of the day, it's about editing your photos. And Aperture is really good at that. One thing in particular I just love is the ability to have it highlight clipped shadows and clipped highlights. So any shadows that have been drowned out go blue, and any clipped highlights go red. And then you simply adjust the recovery slider and the black point slider until you lose all the blue and the red, and then you have your exposure nailed.
Now, which setting is it that turns that on?
Oh, it's in the view menu, and I don't have Aperture launched because it's a bit of a memory hog, and I can't run Skype and Aperture at once in this old machine.
Oh, okay. All right, because I remember I learned about that in the podcast I sent you, but I've forgotten half of what I've learned, of course. Okay.
I've turned it on and just never turned it off.
Okay.
Then there's the other obvious ones that you've mentioned, like the vibrancy and definition sliders.
Oh, I love vibrancy.
Really handy.
So, but you can do more than one line. You can say, why do you like vibrancy? What's good about vibrancy?
Okay. Normally when you turn up the saturation, the brightness begins to go down. So you're then constantly fiddling with two sliders in iPhoto. So you turn up the you turn up the saturation to get more color, and then you've got to turn the brightness up to compensate for the fact that it's all gotten darker. Mm. And you're sort of messing with those two sliders all the time, and you're balancing one against the other, and it's all awkward and messy. With the vibrancy slider, it just makes the colors pop. It's, I think it's exactly the same as the LAB color boost I used to do in a really hard and difficult way using the GIMP, involving decomposing into different color spaces and messing with curves and stuff.
Right, right.
And now it's just a little slider. Whee! Vibrancy up. And I think I'm a bit like Scott Bourne. I like my photographs to pop, so I'm very fond of that vibrancy slider. It goes to +20 on just about every photo, actually.
Now, have you learned that you can actually go higher than that?
Yes, but then it becomes cartoony.
But you can go beyond the limit of the sliders, is my point.
Yes, I've learned that with white balance.
It's true of all of them. I think it's a few.
Yeah.
There's some key you hold down. You can actually, like, it's a command key. And if you go over the number so you're not on the slider, you can actually drag way past. And you know, if you hit a limit, you can keep going. There is no limit.
You can also double click on the text and just type in a number.
Okay.
And so that will really take you over the limit.
Yeah, I like doing the slider, though. It's fun to just go beyond the limits. What about the luminance channel? That's a channel I'd never seen before in other tools.
Yeah, it's one I haven't used much. I've been sort of using the controls that I've been wanting. The other thing that's really nice is the shadows control doesn't make your image look all horrible like the iPhoto one does if you go above 10.
Mm, okay. I also like in levels you can show quarter tone controls. So instead of just
very good.
Instead of just black, white, and gray, you get the quarter tone, so you can be really anal about where you're adjusting.
Yeah, something I do a lot as well, strangely enough. Usually always in the same direction, strangely. It's take the middle one to the left and then take the left quarter point to the left again.
Oh, okay. There are more controls in here than I will ever learn. I'm really happy about that. Like just in highlights and shadows, there's highlights, shadows, radius, color correction, high tonal width, mid contrast, low tonal width.
That's yeah, I haven't just clicked the little advanced triangle yet on that one. I'm happy enough to make those, just move those sliders up and down.
Yeah.
Because they work very well.
Right.
So far, I haven't had an issue with that. And I have to say, the difference in my photographs is marked.
Oh, cool.
I have noticed. I mean, there's a new set I just recently uploaded to Flickr, some snowdrops, which are really hard to do because they're bright white flowers, usually against a dark background, and you tend to blow things and clip things left, right, and center. No, not anymore, because, you know, it goes blue and red, and so having shot raw, I have loads of, you know, control with those sliders, and I can just bring the highlights down, bring the shadows up, and ding, perfect exposure, and it just looks spot on.
How fun. So one of the things I like about the adjustments, there are tons of adjustment options, and you can choose which ones to see. So if you find that you really like to have crop showing all the time, or de-vignette, or monochrome mixer, you can choose to have those show or not show. So you set up, yeah. I think they call them bricks. So you
bricks
can,
or blocks or something
blocks.
Like that. Yeah,
it's
some sort of building metaphor.
It had a B in it and a C and a K somewhere. So, but anyway, you can choose to have these bricks showing or not showing. So the ones that you like to use all the time, like I don't do red eye correction very often. I keep that one turned off. But if you've got a point and shoot camera that gets red eye real bad all the time, or you've got a blonde husband, you can have that be one of your standard things showing.
Yeah, and as you add them, actually, there's a little button just to say make this a default one. It's very handy.
Right. Oh, that drove me crazy at first because one of them, I forget which one it was, levels or something, wasn't there. And I just turned it on. I was like, then I found out how to
remember.
Keep it default.
Yeah. Some of them then are smart. So if you use the cropping tool on a photograph, then the cropping block will show up for that photograph.
Right.
And if you use, the straightening tool, there's another thing. In iPhoto, when you would use the straightening tool, it would straighten up your image, but it would make it all horrible and blurry. It would just lose all its sharpness. When you straighten in aperture, you don't lose all your sharpness.
So you're saying after the photo was sharpened, the it would be blurry?
Oh, no. You would have a photo that was nice and crisp and didn't need any sharpening, and then you would straighten it, and then it would be all blurry, and it would look like the thing wasn't properly focused.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, especially on brickwork. You wouldn't notice it so much on trees and grass and stuff, but anything with brickwork where you had clear little thin hairline lines between the bricks, to really capture the brickwork properly, and then you straighten it because the bleeding horizon isn't right because you were shooting at 18mm and it's just impossible to get that straight. And then in iPhoto, you would have lost all that nice detail in the brick. It would be gone and you wouldn't get it back. So I tried the same in aperture and the detail was not lost, which pleases me a lot because, like I say, if you're shooting wide angle, you don't get things level. It's just not possible.
See, I told you it wasn't a one-liner. You could have said, like the straighten tool.
Okay, fair enough. That's true. But no, I am just so impressed with the array. I've also, for the first time ever, actually not the first time ever, I have played with channel mixers before, but because I had to go into the GIMP for it, it was something I almost never did because it was just a pain in the backside, to be honest. But there is actually a full red, green, blue channel mixer built into one of the blocks, so you can do your black and white conversions with your channel mixing goodness right within aperture.
Nice.
And then you have a sepia block you can add in, so you can add in subtle amounts of sepia because I can't stand horribly orange Oompa Loompa sepia, but a little bit of sepia is nice in a black and white.
I love it. One of the things that's occurring to me is that this is likely, the capabilities in this is likely to hurt Photoshop sales.
Yeah, especially with the plugin architecture, so that you can buy more plugins. Most of them you buy, unfortunately.
There are
some free ones, and there's one I'd like to talk about sometime soon, so I don't want to spoil that now. But a lot of them are paid for, but very powerful.
And but not just paid for, in the hundreds of dollars paid for usually, right? All the ones I've ever heard Robert Lachman talk about from photographyandthemac.com, they're always hundreds of dollars. I think he did one once that was on sale for 60 or something like that.
Which is still too much, Imho. It'd need to be something I do all the time, and Aperture does everything I need to do all the time, so that's not going to happen.
Right, right.
So my MacBook Pro is getting quite old. Bless it, it's about to fall off its Apple Care, so it's coming up to 3 years old. I remember at the time thinking, am I wise to skimp on the RAM? But, oh well, I can't afford 2 gigs, so it's staying at one. Which I regret, by the way. I always regret whenever I do this. It's like I regret not getting the DVD burner in my Mac Mini. You know, those extra few euro really would have saved me well over the years. And likewise with the RAM. So the thing is a Core Duo, not a Core 2 Duo. It has 1 gig of RAM, and Apple quite clearly say that they recommend 2 gigs for Aperture. 1 gig is officially the minimum spec, but they recommend 2. So that worried me. But I'm happy to say that if your camera is 6 megapixels, Aperture is perfectly happy to run on 1 gig of RAM.
Excellent.
I don't think I'd want to do that with a 22 megapixel fancy schmancy new camera. I do not think that would work.
And you know my opinion on megapixels. I think 6 megapixels is fine for 95% of the world.
I'd like 10, but that's just because I have a habit of ending up cropping far too much because I don't have big zoom lenses.
Ah, okay.
I was worried, and I'm not. It's a little sluggish, but it's no more sluggish than iPhoto is when dealing with RAWs. And in fact, it's less sluggish than iPhoto is when dealing with RAWs. So I was happy with that because I was able to tolerate iPhoto's treatment of RAWs, and this is no slower, so all is well.
So iPhoto can handle RAW?
Yeah.
So iPhoto's designed for people who use RAW.
No, it's not designed for it at all. It can handle it, but it's not really very good at it.
Sorry, I was just being obnoxious.
Yeah, I thought you might have been. But no, it doesn't actually let you get any value out of the RAW. It treats it, you know, you get no better than you would with a JPEG.
I see.
Which defeats the purpose quite a bit, to put it mildly. So the other thing I was a bit worried about, I mean, yeah, I have bought my external hard disk, but it's not infinite in size. So I was a little worried about the overhead of going Aperture, because there is overhead. Every image you put into your Aperture library, Aperture generates 2 images from it. It generates a thumbnail, which is used for skimming and stuff, and it generates a preview, which is what you get if you put it into quick preview mode, which is another thing I think is fantastic. I must talk about in a minute. So one image becomes 3. Now, you can then make 50 versions of that image without ballooning out your hard disk anymore, but one image does become 3, so there is a sort of an Aperture tax. And I was pleasantly surprised, because my iPhoto library was 13.66 gigabytes, and when that was Aperture-ified, not that sure that's a real word, but it is now, that went up to 15.33, which actually isn't bad. Now, I should say that my iPhoto library already was a little more bloated than it necessarily needs to be, because when you sync photographs to the iPod Touch, it generates a small version which is stored within your iPhoto library. So my iPhotos already had a preview built into them.
Okay, right, right. Now, I'm wondering if something's going wrong on my system, shockingly, because I took 7 years of photographs from April 2001 to May 2008. In 7 years, I took 46,169 photos and saved in my my external folder structure, not inside iPhoto or Aperture. It was 48.5 gig. I pulled that and my 10 gig iPhoto library, which is just redundant and I really shouldn't have done it, but I pulled that in. That would have been 58 gig was in Aperture. 9 months have passed and my Aperture library is now 80 gig. So it went from 58 to 80 in 9 months.
Okay, but you've been shooting for years and you weren't shooting, you know, at Nikon D40 sizes.
Yeah, but I shot 500 pictures per cross-country meet previous to when I went into Aperture. So I took several thousand photographs during cross-country season, and I've cut way back since then, since I've been in Aperture. There's no way I created 25 gig worth of photos in 9 months. That's not possible. And it's not supposed to be keeping copies, so I need to find out where that's going, because that doesn't make any sense to me.
No, you might want to just keep track of what size stuff is going in from your camera. So look at your library size, import from your camera, and then look at your library size again and just see what's happening.
Yeah. And now, the way I'm figuring out how big this is I'm going into Allison, into Pictures, and then I'm right-clicking on Aperture Library and saying Show Package Contents, and then I'm doing a Get Info on the Aperture Library by itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I'm deciding how big it is.
Seems like as good a way to measure it as any.
Yeah. Now, there's also inside there, when I did a Show Package Contents, I found the iPhoto library inside there. So can I now delete my iPhoto library in iPhoto?
Maybe.
Yeah, see, this is why I have copies of everything. I have everything like 12 times, I think. So.
Yeah, I decided I was doing a clean swap, so I said import from iPhoto, suck it into the Aperture library, and then I copied my iPhoto library to an external disk and deleted it from my hard disk.
You did, okay.
But I have never looked inside the package the package of my Aperture library. I don't know what it looks like in there.
Okay, but it sounds like I should be able to delete that if you did. So now, when you open up iPhoto, it's empty, or you just never go back to iPhoto?
I open up iPhoto and it goes, "Ooh, you don't seem to have a library. Shall I create one?"
Okay,
and I said, "No, go away,"
and quit it. Okay,
so yeah, I just quit it.
You've cut the cord.
I've cut the cord completely because I don't hold with this whole being, you know, half in one camp and half in the other. I did the same when I moved to the Mac. It's just boom.
Oh, but you said you were going to go half in one camp and half in the other. You said you were going to do Faces in iPhoto.
Yes, no, I've decided against that. It's just too much effort to have two applications.
You know, you actually do have to go to iPhoto when you make your Christmas cards. You can't do that.
I did notice that.
Yeah, you have to send them over.
I can make a book, but not cards or calendars.
Right, so you have to go, and it doesn't reference your iPhoto library or your Aperture library to do that. It copies it. Copies all the photos into the other library. Poop. I was kind of bummed by that.
Okay, so you just jumped ahead to another thing that would have annoyed me about a year from now.
Oh, no.
But anyway,
I brought him down.
As I was saying, another good thing. So we're worried about the RAM size and stuff. There's the new mode in Aperture 2 called Quick Preview, and it doesn't actually load the RAW file. It only loads the little preview JPEGs it's generated. So you can really quickly scan through your images, adding in keywords, adding in ratings, all that kind of stuff. Really snappy. And then when you're done and you actually want to edit an image, just turn off the Quick Preview mode, and it will start loading in the RAW each time again.
Yeah, there you go. I do wish there was a faster way to flip from photo to photo to photo to putting in metadata. Like, I'd like to be able to title a photo, hit a tab, and go to the next photo. You know, I put in version names. That's where I put in most of my information. Or even if I want to put in keywords, I want to then, like, hit the right arrow to go to the next picture. And I haven't found a way to easily flip between them.
Well, I actually use the arrow key to flip around, but I'm doing that while I'm doing ratings. So that's arrow key, you know, a number from 1 to 5, arrow key, a number from 1 to 5, arrow key, a number from 1 to 5.
Right.
Then I do my keywording by having the keyword heads-up display up and having it in thumbnail view. So I'm only seeing thumbnails and no big pictures. And then I just select the ones I want and drop the appropriate keyword on it, select the ones I want and drop the appropriate keyword on it. And a lot of the times the keywords you're adding are the same for an entire set. So, you know, Apple A, drop the place on it, maybe a few other things. And then there's one or two individual keywords have to go into individual pictures. But a lot of the time you get a lot of them in one go.
Yeah, that should work. Hey, we are going on awfully long here, but I do want to, I actually want to end on the one thing we absolutely agree on we hate, and that's the fonts.
I know where this is going.
It's the fonts.
Hang on, I want to give you one.
Okay.
Because you're going to be happy about this. I can't believe you haven't mentioned this.
What's that?
What's the thing? What is one of the things in iPhoto that annoyed you absolutely positively no end?
Oh, the list is so long. Give me a hint.
Okay, when you delete a photograph, what happened in iPhoto?
Oh, it went into the secret trash can.
Yeah, Aperture uses the real one.
Yay!
I was very happy about that. And it does it in a very sensible way. It creates a folder in your trash can called Aperture, and then it actually puts the name of the project that came from as another folder, and then the photo goes in there. So you can restore it back out very easily.
Absolutely.
But it's your real recycle bin, so no more hidden space being sucked up by mysterious hidden trash cans.
All right, well, let's go on to
the one we both agree on.
Right, let's end on a cranky note that we both agree on. The fonts. You describe it, Bart. How bad, what it's like.
Well, it's like every other app on the Mac uses the nice standard Apple fonts. They're big, they're clear, they're easy to read. And for some reason, Apple have decided that people who take photographs need to squint.
And you're not old. I mean,
I find them annoying.
What font is it? It's like 8 or smaller, 7 maybe? And it's on a dark background, and you have to, there's no need for it.
It reminds me of OS Classic. And I'm not saying that as a compliment.
Now, in some cases...
It's a sort of a fat... It's a bolded small font.
Yeah.
It's difficult to read. It's hard on the eyes. There is absolutely no need for it. It's in dialogue boxes. It's in buttons. It's everywhere.
And right, right. It's the annoying. Dialogue button boxes that really irritate me. I mean, in some cases, like if you're looking at the adjustments, there's so many there. Maybe it's kind of nice to have it smaller so you can get more in. But in dialogue boxes, you're just pissing me off.
Actually, in the hood, it's fine. Well, I'm not even sure it's the same annoying font inside the hood because I've never noticed that when you have a heads-up display that it's hard to read.
Mm.
It looks like the heads-up display in iPhoto.
Yeah.
But on dialogue boxes and naming stuff and menus, it's horrible.
All right. Well, hey, we've been going on for about an hour and a half here now, I think, not counting our two Skype dropouts.
I'm glad to say that's a slight exaggeration. A little disappointed it's only slight.
Well, do you want to end on anything happy?
I'm just delighted I made the switch, and thank you again for helping me make that switch. It's very much appreciated.
Well, I'm glad we did go into some of the things you like, because I really am getting a kick out of it. I have a lot of fun with it, too. All right, I think we're on schedule for regular next week. Possibly not. We'll have to talk about that. Not sure.
Okay, so until whenever the next time happens to be, happy computing.
Well, it's time for me to wrap up the show and go watch the rest of the Super Bowl, or at least the ads. I hope you've enjoyed this week's show. Be sure to send me your dumb questions, complaints, compliments, whatever you feel like sending on over to Allison@podfeet.com. And be sure to Twitter me at twitter.com/podfeet. And come on over to the chat room on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. GMT-8. Go to ustream.tv/nosilicast and join in the live show. It's a lot of fun. We have a good time in there. You can correct me and throw in your answers to our questions. So come join us next time. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.